This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 4th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, protesters face a ramped-up police presence and new security laws at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. Democrats release their 2012 platform and, for the first time, include marriage equality. And violence and fighting in Syria have displaced thousands inside the country. We'll meet two families whose lives have been upended by the conflict. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. A Pittsburgh jury heard opening arguments today in the retrial of a man who says he's been in jail for 18 years for a crime he didn't commit. Terrell Johnson was one of three people charged in the 1994 killing of Verna Robinson. His two co-defendants were found not guilty. Johnson's conviction was originally overturned on appeal due to ineffective counsel. A superior court reversed that order, but Johnson won another retrial in 2008 when a new witness came forward. He was then offered a deal that would have him admit to third-degree homicide and set him free for time served. But he chose to remain in prison another 3 years and await exoneration in a retrial. Brett Grody is an organizer with the Human Rights Coalition.
The reason why Terrell is taking his chances with this is because he is confident that the evidence will exonerate him, that the Commonwealth does not have credible witnesses that can implicate him.
Pennsylvania is not seeking the death penalty, but if Johnson is convicted again, he will be sentenced to life without parole. A strike shut down much of Indian-administered Kashmir today. Residents are protesting the politicization of an annual Hindu pilgrimage to a shrine in a Himalayan cave located in a predominantly Muslim area. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
Shops and businesses in most towns were shut, and public transport was largely off the roads. But according to police, the day passed peacefully, and response to the strike was feeble. The shutdown was called by hardline separatist leader Syed Ali Shah Gilani amid growing concerns about potential plans to build a paved road to the Amarnath cave. Each year, more than 500,000 Hindu faithfuls travel to the cave during a span of just 6 to 8 weeks. This year, more than 100 died. Last month, the Supreme Court ordered that the infrastructure be improved. The federal government said it would help the state and the Amarnath Shrine Board by widening the tracks in the fragile mountain area. But locals oppose the plan, saying upgrading the paths would cause environmental damage. They say the number of pilgrims allowed to access to the cave should be limited, as it is at other Himalayan shrines. Last week, Gilani also demanded the dissolution of the Amarnath Shrine Board, which is headed by the federally appointed governor of the mostly Muslim state, and demanded that management of the shrine be handed over to Kashmiri Hindus. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
A suicide bomber struck at a funeral in Afghanistan today. At least 25 civilians died and dozens more were injured. No one has yet claimed responsibility. Civilians are often killed in such retaliatory attacks on public events. They're also increasingly killed by pro-government militias. According to the governor of Kunduz, on Sunday, one such group killed 8 civilians after wrongly attributing the death of one of their members to local villagers. And the U.S. military has stopped training 1,000 members of the Afghan local police while they redo background checks. The do-over is intended to stem the so-called green-on-blue attacks of recent months in which at least 45 foreign troops have died. Most of them were U.S. soldiers. Tibetan refugees in India started an indefinite hunger strike in New Delhi, demanding international intervention to stop what they call Chinese atrocities in Tibet. Bismillah Gilani has more.
The Tibetan Youth Congress is the largest pro-independence group representing Tibetan refugees worldwide. They launched the hunger strike Monday. 3 executive members of the group are fasting indefinitely, while dozens of others join them daily as a gesture of solidarity. They say the protest is intended to remind the international community of its responsibility to the people of Tibet. Tenzin Norsong is Joint Secretary of the Tibetan Youth Congress.
We want the international community to send a fact-finding delegation inside Tibet, because there is a 51 cases of self-immolation inside Tibet. It's all because of China's brutal policy against Tibet.
Norsong accuses China of targeting public intellectuals, religious leaders, and artists in what he calls a political witch hunt, and of using brute force to crush any dissent. The refugees also urge the US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, to take up the issue of human rights abuses with Chinese authorities during her Beijing visit beginning today. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
A court in Bahrain today let stand life sentences for 8 pro-democracy activists, including Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja, who fasted for 110 days in protest earlier this year. The court also upheld long yet lesser sentences for 12 others. More than 50 people have died in more than 19 months of uprising in the nation that hosts the 5th Fleet of the U.S. Navy. And in Yemen, an investigation has been launched into an apparent drone attack over the weekend that killed 13 civilians. Investigator Tawfiq Aljami told Agence France-Presse they hope to find the, quote, reason for the error, in which a remotely piloted aircraft dropped a bomb on vehicles carrying civilians near Yemen's central city, Rada'a. The attack came the same day the Yemeni ministry issued a statement saying that on Friday, another drone killed 5 militants in Hadramaut in eastern Yemen. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. As peaceful protests kicked off the Democratic National Convention this weekend, many expressed concern about the massive and costly police presence and introduction of new security laws. Security ordinances passed by the City Council in the months leading up to the DNC could be used to ban scarves, backpacks, helmets, and other common items in the downtown area. Other laws empower police to conduct warrantless searches and outlaw sleeping and camping in public. Police say the measures are necessary to protect the elected officials, thousands of delegates, and local residents during the convention, as well as the protesters themselves. But local activists say the oppressive impact of the laws will remain long after Democrats leave town. From Charlotte, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Activists from across the country are holding demonstrations, marches, and acts of civil disobedience throughout the week of the Democratic National Convention. On the first official day, local Occupy members organized a march in support of Bradley Manning, while other activists held a reproductive rights rally, and pro-environment groups were kicked out of the convention center after protesting at a nuclear energy panel. Tuesday's events and several protests over Labor Day weekend were met with a massive security presence, including local police, county sheriffs, state troopers, the Secret Service, Homeland Security, private security teams, and law enforcement officers from as far away as Chicago and Wisconsin.
It's like an occupation force that's invaded the city.
That's Allende Alcala, an activist with Occupy Charlotte and an organizer of Sunday's March on Wall Street South, which drew between 700 and 1,000 protesters. He called the metal barricades downtown and the thousands of police officers on foot, bicycle, motorcycle, helicopter, and monitoring video unnecessary and disturbing.
We just occupied Marshall Park right here in Charlotte. When I was leaving there yesterday, there was 15 police vans. There were just legions coming out of these doors of officers with cuffs and nightsticks, and like they were marching off to war.
According to documents obtained by the Associated Press, Charlotte has spent at least $50 million in federal funds on vehicles, training, and surveillance equipment for the DNC. Nearly 100 agents will monitor video gathered from the air and on the ground at a massive command center this week, the location of which is classified. Activist Corey Clark came from Pennsylvania for the convention to write and take photos for Occupy Philly Media and has been staying at the Occupy Charlotte camp for the past few nights. He said he experienced high security at the Chicago NATO summit earlier this year and at other national events, but he hasn't seen anything like the police monitoring of Occupy Charlotte.
Helicopters, you know, they march through here, you know, regularly, you know. I mean, they haven't really said anything to anybody, but, you know, it's clearly an act of intimidation, you know, just to, you know, remind that us, you know, that, hey, we're here, you know, don't screw around.
Charlotte police have also been granted the right to conduct warrantless searches within the 10-block security perimeter around the DNC. If a person refuses, the police can choose to arrest him or her. Clark called this an affront to his liberty.
They searched my bag. They searched our storage locker. They were very kind about it. But, you know, the fact that that can happen in America to a journalist is sick. It is a violation of my privacy. I mean, I don't have anything to hide, so it's like, whatever. But I don't want that. And, you know, I shouldn't have to, you know, allow you to search my stuff.
In preparation for the DNC, the city council also passed an extraordinary event ordinance for downtown Charlotte, banning backpacks, duffel bags, coolers, masks, scarves, and helmets if they're carried with the intent to commit a crime or resist law enforcement orders. Another section prohibits carrying, quote, a container or object of sufficient weight to be used as a projectile, which could be interpreted very broadly. Chris Brook with the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina says these laws open the door to unconstitutional searches and seizures.
You know, our concern here is this could lead to standardless searches. It could lead to profiling, as it's really impossible to divine the, you know, whether you're carrying a backpack because you're headed to work or whether you're carrying a backpack because you have the intent to conceal weapons.
At Sunday's March on Wall Street South, just one protester was arrested for covering her face with a scarf in violation of the city ordinance that took effect on Saturday. Alcala, who lives and works in Charlotte, said he's concerned these same laws could be used against local activists in the future.
They sold it to the city that citizens just assumed that these DNC ordinances would end, but there's no sunset clause. They actually will continue indefinitely, and these are the legacy that will be left on the citizens of this city. Not just protesters and not just activists, but everyday citizens who are just coming to and from work, trying to enjoy parks. And that's why it's such a threat and why people have to stand up.
With many more scheduled and spontaneous protests yet to come, some activists say they'll be testing the boundaries of the convention security force, exercising their First Amendment rights so as not to lose them. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Charlotte.
Today, Democrats are expected to formally approve their party's platform. Much of it focuses on remedies for the economy and rebuilding what it calls middle-class security. But it also includes positions on key social issues. It calls for comprehensive immigration reform, a goal the Obama administration has failed to achieve so far. The platform pledges to ensure access to affordable family planning, contraception covered by health insurance, and safe and legal abortion for women. And for the first time, Democrats have included support for same-sex marriage. For more on the development of LGBT rights, we're joined by Stacey Long, Director of Public Policy and Government Affairs at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Action Fund. She joins us from Charlotte. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you so much, Dorian. Happy to be here.
The Democratic Party platform reads, and I'll quote the line, it says, "We support marriage equality and support the movement to secure equal treatment under law for same-sex couples." Your reaction to that inclusion in the party platform?
Well, we're certainly thrilled that the Democratic platform includes our issue. And the marriage equality issue, of course, is a very important one. The platform includes a number of other priority issues that the task force cares about, including employment protection in the form of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which is really important. It's so important that we are putting a public education awareness campaign out there just to drive home the point that it's really critical that people understand we still don't have those federal level protections enshrined in law. We don't have a federal law that provides these protections, the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity.
So there has been so much emphasis on jobs and the economy, that worker place non-discrimination support for those laws and that protection that is included in the platform?
Yes, that's included. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act is also a reference to the HIV/AIDS battle, the continued need for providing funding for research and prevention and treatment services for those who are impacted by HIV/AIDS. And the bullying issue is something that's also mentioned in the platform. So we really got something for many segments of our community, our population that's grappling with employment discrimination, grappling with feeling safe in our schools and in our streets, and feeling the difficulties of trying to be safe in our bodies in terms of health care.
Now, President Obama has come out and said publicly that he does support marriage equality, same-sex marriage, but he did not always take that position. And for much of his political career, he stopped short of endorsing same-sex marriage. What has been the role of advocacy, of grassroots activists in pushing for this?
Well, I believe that a lot of the work that our organization has done in terms of having face-to-face conversations with prospective voters is really giving people an opportunity to hear directly about the issues, not just take at face value what they may have heard in another quadrant, such as TV, or maybe they attend a place of worship that is not affirming of LGBT issues. And so our organization, through our campaigns on the ground, have been able to knock on doors and talk to people, answer questions, ask them what their views are. And, you know, the mood of the country is moving clearly in the direction that's favorable for us. I mean, for the first time, the majority of Americans do support marriage equality. So it really is an exciting time, and we're just happy that the president was able to evolve in the direction that he's evolved in, because we feel like this is the right position for him to take.
Stacey Long, you're there at the convention in Charlotte. According to the Stonewall Democrats, there are more than 500 LGBT participants at the convention. Marriage equality is one of the issues. You've mentioned several others. What other issues are LGBT delegates concerned about?
LGBT delegates are concerned about the full variety of issues that the American public is concerned about. I mean, I can only speak for the Task Force Action Fund and say that we're certainly committed to making sure that people are safe in their homes and safe in the streets, safe in their schools, and able to find and keep a job that pays a living wage. We also are concerned about some of the policies that have been somewhat anti-immigrant. They've been directed at people based on how they look, and we know what that feels like. And so to eradicate some of the racial profiling practices that are going on, we've been involved in some of those activities as well. So I haven't talked to all 5,000 people who are here, but I imagine they care about being able to make a living, provide for their families, and be able to keep their loved ones together in a safe and safe and loving manner.
Stacey Long is Director of Public Policy and Government Affairs at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Action Fund. She joined us from Charlotte, North Carolina, where the Democratic National Convention is taking place. Stacey Long, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Dorian.
Union organizers from across the South and across the country are gathered at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina this week, some to support President Obama's reelection and some to call him out for not taking stronger stances on labor rights. Republicans routinely accuse the Obama administration of being too close to labor, but many union members voiced criticism of the administration, which they fault for failing to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, freezing the wages of federal workers, and holding the convention in the least unionized state in the country. FSRN spoke to local and national organizers in Charlotte about their views on the complicated relationship between unions and the Democratic Party.
I'll always remember the 3rd of September. I'll always remember the 3rd of September. I'll always remember the 3rd of
Southern workers cannot wait for the Democratic Party, and certainly not the Republican Party, to enact some progressive labor laws before we can begin serious efforts to organize ourselves into a labor movement.
There's plenty of reason to be critical of the president. He hasn't done enough, hasn't stood firmly enough, but I think it's up to us from the bottom up to really organize and push as a movement to bring about change, thereby, you know, forcing the president to have to address our issues. You know, most of us don't want to see a Mitt Romney in office. That's not going to help the situation. But we're also not going to continue to be, you know, always having to take the lesser of two evils.
We doesn't came here against Obama. We doesn't came here about the Democrats. We came here to be heard, because the Republicans, they take already they take their side that they want. And this is anti-immigrants, anti-union, anti-people. But we came here because Democrats need to say, okay, we are for equal rights for everybody here.
We're not here to support leaders just because they have a D after their name. Our labor movement is supporting some Republicans as well as Democratic leaders. But right here, right now, we have a chance to stand with the leaders who champion working families. And my friends, President Barack Obama shares our vision, and he shares our value.
As someone who grew up 60 miles northwest of here, I can tell you firsthand, this is an anti-union state. It is tough for workers here. But I am confident that that's going to change.
We're proud to be here.
And I believe that one day, in the not too distant future, there will be unionized hotels here in the city of Charlotte. And I believe that one day public employees in this state will have the right to collectively bargain. And I believe that one day right to work for less will be nothing but a distant memory.
That was North Carolina AFL-CIO Secretary-Treasurer Mary B. McMillan, AFL-CIO President and Pennsylvania Delegate Richard Trumka, undocumented worker Martin Onsueta, Ashaki Binta with the Black Workers for Justice, Saladin Mohammed with the Southern International Worker Justice Campaign, and Jeribu Hill with the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights, speaking at Monday's Southern Workers Assembly and Tuesday's AFL-CIO Labor Delegates Meeting at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. FSRN's Alice Olstein recorded and produced this segment. Violence in Syria forced an estimated 100,000 refugees across borders to Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq during the month of August. That's the highest monthly total since the conflict began, according to the UN's refugee agency, which released the tally today. The UN says there are more than 230,000 people in the region who have registered as refugees or are awaiting registration. But these refugees are still only a partial count as a larger migration crisis unfolds inside Syria. With fighting reaching the country's two largest urban areas, Aleppo and Damascus, the number of people displaced internally has tripled over the summer. The Syrian Arab Red Crescent says more than 1.5 million civilians have left their homes but have stayed inside the country. That's about one in every 15 Syrians. FSRN's Marine Olivesi met two displaced families inside Syria. She found out that in addition to lacking humanitarian aid, they also have little sense of safety.
A cardboard box of potatoes, a saucepan half full of oil, and some wood. It's another night where Om Suteif has very little to fix dinner with. She says there's no water, no electricity, no gas these days in Mat Masrin, a town north of Idlib under control of the Free Syrian Army. Her sister's family found refuge here a month ago when clashes broke out in Aleppo. Overnight, her household increased fivefold. Om Suteif takes the first batch of potatoes out and serves the golden slices on a plate. Enough to feed one stomach, she says. She's got 21 to go. Marwan, her brother-in-law and a father of six, works in a clothing factory in Aleppo. During the first year of the uprising, Marwan says they'd been shielded from most of the violence, so he and many others in Syria's commercial hub clung to business as usual. Marwan says his attitude stemmed from disbelief, tinged with the hope that everything would get back to normal sooner or later. Marwan says the turning point occurred when refugees from homes and other parts of the country started trickling to Aleppo last winter.
We saw the family coming from everywhere to Aleppo. They realize there is something wrong, and the situation going crazy more than before.
The first wave of displacement into Aleppo brought Syria's most populous town to a boil. Marwan says protests started growing throughout the spring and they were met with increasing repression. Clashes in Aleppo escalated into a full-on war in July, and today most of those who were still trapped inside embattled neighborhoods are refugees themselves. This man lives in Salah Eddin, one of the neighborhoods battered by fierce fighting. He says many of those who've already been displaced just can't afford to leave and resettle again.
He said there is a lot of civilians, refugees from outside, from Homs, for example. And all the people, the Alapian people, they live in Salah Eddin. Who stay in Salah Eddin now, who didn't have money, enough money to leave.
Little did he know that his family would soon meet the same fate. Two local Free Syrian Army fighters were found dead later that day in Mat Masrin. The town rallied before the funerals and pointed fingers at a Shia militia from a pro-Assad village nearby. The FSA attacked and destroyed an army convoy passing by the next day. Fighter jets bombed Mat Masrin in retaliation. Marwan's family was left hunkering down in the basement of a school, while most locals fled the shelling by going to farms in the countryside. The cycle of violence and of displacement goes on. For families across Syria, staying put or hitting the road in search of a somewhat safer place is now a question that begs a daily reassessment. This family of 40 people has moved no less than 6 times in 1 month. Subheya, the grandmother, recounts how it started.
We started moving 10 days before Ramadan because the Assad army was shelling our village. We walked under the shelling on the road to another village, not far. They started shelling that place as well. We moved to another village, and it happened again. It's like bombs were following us.
Then they decided to split. Half of them would go to Damascus, the other half to Aleppo. They had relatives in both cities, and both cities had been Syria's last two safe havens. One woman in the group who went to Damascus late July says she saw blood splashed on 4 floors of a building after a bomb landed in the middle of a protest. She had to walk on bodies to make it out of the street. The other group in Aleppo had no easier time. Here's Subheya again.
We had to escape, but we couldn't go on the streets because shelling and fighting was raging. We crossed the town through the backyards. We jumped up and down walls, over iron gates and burning tires. They were bombing all around us. It was hard for everyone, but we were so scared we just kept going, house by house.
The family regrouped in Mat Masrin before shelling forced them to leave once more. I met them in an abandoned clinic in a village nearby. About 2/3 of the extended family are just kids and teenagers. One of the grown-ups says they might go to Turkey next, yet they still hope they don't have to leave Syria. Our children are the reason why we're bouncing around the country, this man says. We want to make sure they're safe. At the beginning, they were crying every time we moved, but not anymore. This has become our normal life. Marine Olivesi, FSRN, Mat Masrin, Syria.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.